Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF, Donnelly Stewart Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together, we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
I have Kevin D. Pham, the author of The Architects of Dignity, Vietnamese Visions of Decolonization. I had Kevin and his co-host Ian on several weeks ago. They host the Nam Phong Dialogues. Today we have Kevin here to talk more about the book, and I find it a very interesting topic here, Kevin. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
So you wrote this book, and you know, I know that from the last podcast that you've been back and forth to Vietnam, and you know, you have your interest is in Vietnam's history. Can you tell me about how you got to this point?
Yeah. Well, the short answer is that I lived in Vietnam for 8 months after my grandparents on my dad's side died. And I lived in Vietnam because I was ashamed of not speaking the language. And I wanted to relearn Vietnamese, and I wanted to learn more about Vietnam. And so in 2010, I lived in Nha Trang, and when I would walk around, I would see names on street signs, names, lots of names of national heroes, Phan Chu Trinh, Phan Boi Châu Street, you know, all these names. And so that made me curious, who are these people? And I would hear my aunts and uncles talk about them too. And so I was curious if they had any political theories. So when I was in college, I loved the topic of political philosophy. What is political philosophy? It asks questions like, what is a good life? Should we think of ourselves as individuals pursuing our private goals, and we leave others alone to pursue theirs? Or should we think of society where, you know, we put the community above all? You know, how should we, you know, what should our values be? How should we organize society? Should we have a democracy where lots of people rule, or a king, you know, a monarchy? And so when I studied political theory in college, I noticed that all the thinkers that we studied were basically Europeans, you know, Thomas Hobbes, Rousseau, Locke, and, you know, all those, the canon of political theory. And I just never saw any Vietnamese thinkers. So I was curious, did Vietnamese people have political theories? So that's the short answer of it.
You know, I feel you when you said that you walk down the streets in Vietnam and you see all the names of these heroes, right? And I would imagine in my mind that we, as the loser of this war, the children of these people, probably share some of the names of these streets somehow, maybe. But they renamed a lot of these streets. So I share what you went through, the experience of wondering what these people's names were. But here's where it gets really tricky. I wanted to do mini episodes about each one of those names, starting with Trần Hưng Đạo, right? I wanted to make these subcategories of a podcast to just kind of like highlight the names. So I go back and I talk to my family and friends. They're like, no, don't do that. You'll get banned. You'll get your butt kicked by the community in the United States, the Vietnamese American community. You can't do that. You don't have enough political depth to understand the names that are associated with the heroes that the new government picked out. So that is why when I read your book, you selected a few names to kind of like talk about political theory. And, you know, some of these names happen to be some of the names that I'm wondering about. So here we are at this intersection of these names of heroes of the Vietnamese world. But then we live in a weird, you and I probably live in a weird space, and probably you don't live in that space the way I do, because you're an academic and you're like, well, I'm just here to really just spotlight the reality and the truth, right? But there's some political implications that I fear, which I shouldn't fear. But I know I'd love to talk to you about this. Your book is called The Architects of Dignity. And I don't think that there's any political lines, or is there, or any political decisions when you set out to write this book. So why don't we start there? How did you start out to write this book?
Yeah, well, let me begin by saying, so my parents were refugees from South Vietnam. I grew up in a very anti-communist family. My aunts and uncles, very anti-communist. And I remember, it was funny, I was a teenager and I had, of course, heard of Ho Chi Minh. And one day I decided to Google Ho Chi Minh's writings, and I started reading them. I was a teenager. I didn't know anything. And then I went downstairs to where my dad was watching TV, and I went up to him and I just blurted out, "Dad, I'm reading some Ho Chi Minh, and he seems like a patriot. He seems like a good guy." And then I run back upstairs, and then
what was his reaction to that?
Hold on, I'm not done. So I didn't let him say anything. I just ran back upstairs. I just went downstairs. I blurted it out. Later that night, when I came back downstairs, I went into the kitchen where he was cooking, and he stopped cooking. He put down his knives and forks and whatever, and he went up to me, and he put his finger in front of my face, and he said, "Kevin, don't you ever say Ho Chi Minh was a good guy. You can say anything except that." And I had never seen him that serious before. And so I was probably 17 or something. And I thought to myself, wow, how can someone have so much, have such this a strong this? Right. And so that made me even more curious about Vietnamese history. And so that's one thing I wanted to bring up, that my family is very anti-communist. However, when I went to college, my best friends were very left-leaning. I had friends who called themselves communists, who called themselves Marxists. And so it was very weird for me to be with my family, who I loved, you know, and then be with my friends, who I loved. And so that is what got me interested in ideology. Ideologies are lenses through which we view the world. Ideologies help explain the world. Why is there inequality? You know, a conservative might say, well, some people are lazy. But a Marxist would say, no, it's because people are exploited by capitalists. So ideologies are fascinating. And so what I wanted to know were, what were the ideologies of these great thinkers? So how did I choose the thinkers? I lived in Vietnam, and I would just ask people on the street, and any Vietnamese person, young person, educated people, old people, I would just ask them, who is an important Vietnamese figure? And it was very easy to come up with the first two names, Phan Boi Châu and Phan Chu Chin, or Phan Châu Chin. And so they are simply the two most important nationalists of the early 20th century, hands down. You know, they are often heard in the same breath, the two together. So that was easy. The second two, Nguyễn An Ninh and Pham Quyền, I learned about them by reading books on Vietnamese history, and their names just kept going up. These two are very different from Phan Boi Châu and Phan Chu Chin. Phan Boi Châu and Phan Chu Chin were writing in Chinese, classical Chinese, and they were the first ones to be exposed to ideas from the West, but it was Nguyễn An Ninh and Pham Quyền who were raised in French language schools, so they could speak and write fluent French, and they could read the ideas of Westerners directly. And so they were from a much younger generation, like 30 years younger than Phan Boi Châu and Phan Chu Chin. And then the last two are, of course, Ho Chi Minh and Nguyễn Minh Tuong. You know, if I write a book about Vietnamese political thought, and the audience for my book are political theorists who know nothing about Vietnam, they're going to think it's really weird that I leave Ho Chi Minh out. So, right, of course, I have to do that. And I chose Nguyễn Minh Tuong, who is a fascinating figure. You probably remember from the last episode with Ian that Nguyễn Minh Tuong he got in trouble by the Communist Party in the 50s because he critiqued them, and he thought he was going to go to jail for the rest of his life. And he brought one book with him, which is Michel de Montaigne's essays. And Montaigne happens to be my favorite philosopher. And so I was, of course, drawn to Nguyễn Minh Tuong. Anyway, that's how I chose the thinkers.
Now, we, growing up in the West, young people like us, I'm like almost 50, I'm like thinking of myself as a young person, because I frankly, I don't know much about this side of Vietnamese history. It's not talked much about in our families, these six figures that you bring up. So I'd like it if we can go through each person, and I'm not sure where to start, but I think that Phan Boi Châu is who I hear about quite often. And to me, that's, other than Ho Chi Minh, is the most notable person that I know. And I'd like to start with him and then work probably to Phan Chu Chin, because it's the two of them sort of are in the same time period. So if we can talk a little bit about each one of them and not spend too much time, but sort of illuminate their life and how, what they contributed to political theory, Vietnamese political ideology and theory.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I just really quickly first say, though, why I chose this colonial period? When I was growing up in California, I heard so much about the war, and honestly, I was tired of hearing about the war. And watching documentaries, I was tired of seeing Vietnamese people be portrayed only as victims, right, or as puppets. And I wanted to see if Vietnamese people were creative thinkers. And so anyway, let me go straight to Phan Boi Châu. Phan Boi Châu gets it all starting. It all started. And by all, I mean the whole anti-colonial movement. So the French conquer Vietnam from 1858 until the late 1800s. So their control over all of what we call Vietnam ends by the late 1800s, okay? And Phan Boi Châu was born in 1867. So he is born into this process of the French taking over. Now, how did the Vietnamese initially react to French colonialism? Well, quite interesting, because there were rebellions, there were uprisings, but it was also like, how do we make sense of these foreigners? What's going on? Well, the first reflex would be to blame the king. You know, the king made this happen. We have a bad king. You allowed this to happen. But at the time, there was also a very influential ideology called social Darwinism. Listeners probably know about it. And it basically suggested that France conquered Vietnam because France was strong and Vietnam is weak. And that's the law of nature. The strong conquer the weak. And so many Vietnamese at the time were thinking, well, what made France strong? Was it their ideas? Is it our weakness? The Vietnamese had been spending all this time studying Confucian classics, learning how to be moral people. Meanwhile, Europeans are learning about math and science and technology and creating advanced weapons and things like that. Maybe we need to step up our game, you know? So social Darwinism was a really influential ideology, especially because the guy who came up with it, Herbert Spencer, was the most influential thinker in Europe at the time. Phan Boi Châu, he admits that he's not very sophisticated in ideas. When he was a young boy, he would like gather his friends and play like fight the French. You know, they would create little weapons and like, we're going to get you and kill you. So he wanted to expel the French using violence. You know, let's get rid of the French and let's restore the monarchy. So in a sense, he's kind of a conservative revolutionary, by which I mean he wants to get rid of the French and then just go back to what they had,
yeah.
Right? He didn't really think about new ideas of organizing political life, like a democracy where people, not a king, have power. And he even admits it. He says, I've been a failure, you know, but he did a lot of work. He traveled throughout Vietnam trying to gather groups of people to organize. And then something really important happens in 1905. In 1905, the Japanese defeat the Russians in a war. And Asians, including like Middle Easterners, they love it. They're really excited because for the first time, Asians have beat white people. And it suddenly seems possible that Asians can beat white people. They saw the Russians as white. And so what does Phan Boi Châu do? He goes to Japan to study, to figure out, you know, how did you do this? Japan was going through reforms, the Meiji Restoration, and they are advancing. They're learning from the West, and they're modernizing. And so Phan Boi Châu is really inspired. He also goes with Phan Chu Trinh to Japan. And together they walk around and they learn, they see the schools that the Japanese are creating, and they basically talk to each other and they're like, look at how superior these people are compared to the Vietnamese. Like, look at the level of our people. How embarrassing. And so this is my first theme of the book, which is shame. These thinkers, all of these thinkers, in their own way, they shame the Vietnamese. Kind of like a parent, you know? You love your kids and you're like, you're so much better than what you're doing now. You know, okay. You're capable of so much.
Yeah. I wanna stop right here. This is the kind of stuff that my dad did to me. Not shaming me. He didn't shame me. Uh-huh. He shamed the Vietnamese culture. He constantly did that with me. It was a constant put down. It was like, look at the West. Look at the Israelis, look at the Japanese, look at the German engineering, look at other people, look at what they're doing. We walked out of the jungle. He constantly did this. And I think his older brothers did that to him because they were, you know, top students. They were the shining stars, the valedictorians in these Western La Salle schools in Saigon. They were elite. They were poor, but they came from elite institutions from the French in the 40s. And I think that my father, that bled into his consciousness, and then it bled into mine because he kept doing that to me. It's constant. And the fact that you're bringing this up, that these two guys go to Japan, oh my God, I'm like getting goosebumps. And this is the root of where all this shame comes from in my life. So I am happy that you're pointing this out.
So one thing I want to be clear is that I did not expect to find this amount of shaming in their writings, but I didn't expect it. But it was really prominent. And what I realized, though, is that they were using shame in a productive way. They were trying to channel this emotion of shame into productive purposes. It was not like shame on you and it's kind of a destructive, you know, and then just give up or whatever. But it was actually trying to motivate the Vietnamese to rise to the occasion. So what was it like that for you or no?
No, it was like, don't be like that. Be like them. But let me ask you something. You just brought up a point, and you really tried to make this point right now, that they didn't try to, you know, destroy or be destructive. But let me ask you something. Do you feel like it had destructive results? Now that you're like on the other end of history, you've spent time studying it. Do you think, because I can tell you, it's very destructive to think this way. Because I've lived my life comparing myself with the rest of the world constantly. And it goes from macro to micro and from micro to macro. It just constantly fluctuates. And I don't think that I'll ever get rid of it. But hey, I mean, I'm doing this podcast and I think that it's built into me. And, you know, now I have to navigate my language around the comparative talk and discussion. So, I mean, in a way, it's good for what I do. But I don't think it's good. It was good for my life for the first 45 years of my life. It was actually really destructive. And how do you feel about, you know, these two thinkers, you know, coming back and doing this comparison? I mean, I think it's fairly destructive, but maybe you might have a different perspective.
I think I do have a different perspective, but I'm glad you bring this up because it's a good segue to the next thinker, Nguyen An Ninh. I do think that it worked out quite well for them, and here's why. So Phan Chu Chin, let me just say a little bit about him. He goes to Japan with Phan Boi Cho, and then he spends a lot of time in France later. And when he comes back from France in 1925, he gives a speech to the Vietnamese, and he says, look, I've been in Europe, and here's what I've learned. The Europeans are better Confucians than us. For Phan Chu Chin, he was a Confucian scholar, and for him, Confucius taught the truth, which is ethics. You know, how should we treat each other? How should we cultivate ourselves? And he thought that the Europeans were better Confucians than the Vietnamese because the Europeans had nationalism. They cared about their country. They treated each other well. And so he said, the Europeans have democracy, and that's what we need. We need to have democracy. Because for too long, Vietnamese monarchs had been abusing their power and making us all stupid. The Vietnamese people, they don't have any sense that they live in a country. They just see themselves as subjects of a ruler. They don't see themselves as citizens of a country. We need to change that. And so he said, Confucius is the truth, but Confucius doesn't say anything about what to do if a ruler is bad. But democracy does give an answer. Democracy is the answer. If the ruler is bad, the solution is not to get a new ruler. It's to have everybody be rulers and ruled at the same time. And so Phan Chu Chin introduces democracy, this idea, to Vietnam. Zan Chu, right? The people are the landlords. The people are the masters. People are the owners of the country. So Phan Chu Chin introduces this new political vocabulary into Vietnam. And then other thinkers are going to take it in new directions. So that was quite productive. Now,
can I ask you, oh my God, I got 1,000 questions. When you say he comes back and he has introduced this idea of Zhen Zhou, which is democracy, what's his platform? I mean, there's no Instagram, there's no Facebook. I mean, what is he, you know, this is 1905 or 1925. How is he getting the message out?
So in 1926, so keep in mind he dies in 1926. And a few months before he died, he gave two speeches in Saigon. These are just speeches to a room full of people. One speech is about monarchy and democracy. And he's just explaining to the Vietnamese what democracy is. And then another speech is about the differences between ethics in the East and ethics in the West. And there are stories where people, after they listen to him, the world has changed. Like the audience reaction was just like, oh my God, our eyes have been open. And so his platform are speeches. So that's the answer there.
And who is he speaking to? And where is this room? Is it in a ballroom at the Continental? I mean, what are we looking at here?
Yeah. It's been a while since I wrote the book, but I can get the name of the place.
I was wondering what kind of,
maybe I should tell the listeners, read my book. You will get the name of the room.
Yeah. Is it a town square? I mean, what is he on a soapbox?
It's a center. It's an institution. I forget the exact name. I can pull it up in a little bit, but you know, readers can easily find it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, and why don't they put him to death? Why doesn't somebody immediately put the boot on his neck and say, stop doing this? You know, I can't imagine a government of France or anybody allowing, you know, of some Vietnamese people to talk like this in a room full of people. Why isn't he stopped?
Yeah. That's a good question. That's a good question. I mean, he's very old at that time, and he's very sick. I mean, he's very sick. But one thing that I wanted to get to was what you were saying earlier about shame, constantly comparing yourself to others and so on. Nguyen An Ninh is a very interesting figure because he's a very young guy. He was born in 1900, and And in 1923, he gives a speech. Again, these are speeches to crowds of people. And he's giving a speech to the Vietnamese, and he's basically saying, look at India, look at Japan, look at Europe. These societies, they have a rich intellectual culture. The Vietnamese don't. The Vietnamese have been pathetically mimicking parroting Confucianism from Chinese thinkers, and all they know is Confucius. And Nguyen An Ninh is going to say, what we need to do as Vietnamese is we need to think for ourselves. We need to learn, we need to read and study different cultures and the great thinkers from other cultures, but not to copy them, not to be like them, but to just create our own ideas. We need to be like vampires, he says, like sucking the lifeblood from everywhere in order to create a new Vietnamese person. And you asked me if I see that working. I do, actually. If I go to Vietnam today, I see it. It's amazing. Like, people really are good at taking from different cultures and making something better. I think that that's what Vietnamese people tend to do, especially since it's difficult to identify an indigenous Vietnamese culture, given Chinese rule over the Vietnamese for 1,000 years, 111 BC to 938 AD. So Chinese philosophy and culture is baked into Vietnamese culture. I was, a few days ago, I was at the museum, the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, and the exhibit was Asian bronze, and I saw bronze drums, Vietnamese bronze drums. This is basically the only symbol of a pre-Chinese Vietnamese identity here. And I showed my brother the designs, and he's like, that doesn't look Vietnamese at all, because we think of, Chinese designs and stuff. But the point I want to make is that it was very difficult for the Vietnamese thinkers, the key figures, to identify a Vietnamese indigenous culture. So many of them were like, we need to make it.
That's interesting. You know, my father always said that to me too. He said, we don't have great thinkers. We don't have great writers. We don't have the Victor Hugos, or we don't have the the Sartre and the Descartes, we don't have these thinkers in Vietnam. We don't have anybody that could go toe-to-toe with the West. That's what he was saying as I was growing up.
You know what? After I wrote this book, I can say he was, wrong. With all due respect, I think mistaken. I do think that reading some of these figures, and they haven't been translated to English, Pham Quynh, I think, is a brilliant writer.
Great.
I was reading him in French. Brilliant. Nguyen Minh Tung, like, oh my gosh. These are really actual, I think, really genius. And I don't use it, I don't think I'm exaggerating. By genius, I mean like they are creating original ideas, really, taking from other sources and creating novel political theories.
You know, I'm going to take a quick break here and really tell you how funny this moment is for me. This is my fifth year doing this podcast. And I think that all of the work that I've done, I've been looking for this conversation, like this pinpoint conversation of shame, of where this all begins, and talking to you. Maybe you should have your own podcast.
I do. I have it with you.
I'm totally joking. I'm just saying it's amazing that you do have a podcast and that you should never stop, because this, like I said, this is the point of, going into my fifth year. I've been looking for this conversation, and I can't tell you the last, 30 minutes, how wonderful. And it's playing in my mind all these scenarios growing up being full of historical shame. I say this quite a bit. I'm close to 6 foot tall. I was in the Marine Corps. I've done everything to assimilate to become a white American male, to be possibly not insecure going into society, but it still lives inside of me because of this belief that there are no shiny things pre-1975 all the way to 2,000, 3,000 years of history of the Vietnamese. And in fact, I'm actually working on a documentary that talks about this very shame. So talking to you today is sort of like, it's incredible to hear you. And I can't wait to talk more about this, but just wanted to stop to tell you that.
Thank you. You know, that really means a lot to me. One thing that I forgot to say was that when I was in college, I wanted a book about Vietnamese ideas, and I couldn't find it. There were history books, but they were full of historical details that I didn't really care about. They were long and kind of hard to read. So I basically wrote the book that I wanted to read, and I wrote it to myself when I was 18. I literally imagined little Kevin, and this is for little Kevin. So it's easy to read. It's not very academic-y, but I can genuinely tell you that I think these thinkers are brilliant. And I read a lot of political theory. I have read so many Western thinkers. But what's interesting about these thinkers is that they are politically engaged. You know, they're trying to deal with a real problem here. Our changing society, we've been Confucian, now here are all these new ideas from the West. We're being humiliated, we're being dominated. The French soldiers are, Ho Chi Minh, for example, he just has lots of stories of how the French are abusing and humiliating the Vietnamese, just lists and lists of detailed stories. And what do you do with this anger and this indignation? You need to channel it somewhere. Just by the way, totally unrelated, but still related. I don't know if you've heard of this, Kenneth, but apparently there was in the UK, there's a pho restaurant. But it's called like pho restaurant, but it's like owned by white people. And they basically tried to sue a mom and pop pho restaurant for using the word pho.
God.
Like this kind of fury and anger, like it's like a flash of emotion. And there's a word for it. It's called indignation. Now, like we want to react with anger. You want to break some stuff, right? Yeah. And so for the Vietnamese who are dealing with a bigger issue, I think, colonialism, they need to figure out how to channel that anger. And at first they use violence, but what's going to happen? The French have way better weapons. You're going to be killed. You're going to be sent to jail. And many were sent to jail. And so what do you need to do? You need to channel it somewhere. So my whole book is about how do these thinkers channel their anger? In what directions did they channel it? And they need to channel into something productive, not destructive.
Are there books out there that you read that had biographies of Fan Boy Zhou and Fan Chu Jing and, you know, all these guys? Were there books that you were, and are these books, if we as second generation Vietnamese Americans were caught with our parents going, hey, why are you reading that? Does it reflect any political ideology, or are they pretty neutral books on history?
This is a fantastic question, so thank you. So the short answer is yes, there are books. So for example, let me just start with Fan Boy Zhou. You can read the memoirs of Fan Boy Zhou. It's called An Overturned Chariot in English. There is a collection of Fan Chu Chin's political writings edited by Vin Sin. And Nguyen An Ninh, there's a broader history that touches on Nguyen An Ninh. It's called Radicalism and the Roots of the Vietnamese Revolution. These books, I mean, the first two that I mentioned are written by like the figures themselves, but Radicalism and Roots of the Vietnamese Revolution, that's by Hue Tam O Dai, who's a professor at Harvard. She's retired now. And also another two very important books are Vietnamese Anti-Colonialism by David Marr, and also Vietnamese Tradition on Trial, also by David Marr. David Marr was kind of the person I looked up to. He was an intelligence officer in Vietnam in 1962. So he's quite, he's much older, right? But I've been emailing back and forth with him, and I know that some scholars of Vietnam might have some issues with his interpretations because he's more, how should I say this carefully? I mean, he's more, I guess, kind of on the left, or, you know, or kind of, I don't want to say like pro Ho Chi Minh, but no, you know, like sort of there, kind of, but of course, very nuanced and so on. But like Keith Taylor, you know, he was also, these are big names, David Marr, Keith Taylor, and they both have something in common, which is that they were young men who learned Vietnamese and went to Vietnam during the war. And, you know, and they were there. And after they got their PhDs and they studied, they fell in love with Vietnamese history. Keith Taylor is much more like, I want to talk about this actually. So growing up in Southern California and hearing about the Vietnam War, almost everybody's like, it was wrong for the US to get involved, right? Like they're all anti-Vietnam War, by which they mean the US were imperialists, et cetera, et cetera. But our stories, the South Vietnamese stories, never get told, right? Like it's completely ignored. A lot of leftists see the war as America against the Vietnamese, right? Like when really, of course, it was a civil war. But Keith Taylor, he's going to say, was it wrong for the U.S. to get involved? It's actually more complicated. You know, he thinks the U.S. had a good cause in Vietnam, and maybe they carried out poorly, but they had a cause. You know, and hearing that from him just shows me how much more nuanced that we should think about the war, of course.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
D Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
Anyway, how did I get to
this? No. I've heard Keith Taylor's name pop up on this podcast several times. Just recently, Joseph Wynn, spoke about Keith Taylor and how it changed his academic trajectory. So I think that that is a name that we all should start paying attention to. David Marr, I've heard as well. And I think that I want to now explore more with, because I'm wondering, like, what were these guys, you know, Fan Bojin, Fan Bojiao and Fan Chujing, how did they grow up? Who influenced these guys to go off on a trajectory to go to, how did you even get to Japan, right? In those days, like, was there visas? I mean, what brought you to Japan and why were they there at the same time? And were they elite people where they had a lot of money and they could travel and then they were free of like making a living and they could just think for them, for their, you know, their leisure lads, right? So I want to know. I'm desperate to know all this stuff.
Yeah, I won't go into that because it's all in the book. It's so
wonderful.
What I do want to discuss more though was that Japan, the significance of Japan, since you're talking about this, there was a whole movement to bring Vietnamese students to Japan. The Dongzhu movement, the go east and learn from Japan. If I could summarize all of like Vietnamese political thinking in the early 1900s, it was simply, let's try to do what Japan is doing.
Wow. Right? So there's a movement called Dongzhu, which is travel east. Zoo is to travel, so travel east.
Yeah. And so these thinkers, they get it going. Now I do want to move on to a very fascinating figure, Pham Quyn. Pham Quyn was seen by historians and also the Viet Minh as a traitorous collaborator. So, well, I need to qualify what I'm saying here, but when the Viet Minh took power in 1975, they arrested him and they took him to a force and they killed him. And what was fascinating to me is that in 2018, I'm in Hanoi and I'm just walking around. It's a lovely evening and I stumble into a bookstore and then I see a book, a beautiful modern looking fancy orange book, a very thick book by Pham Quyn. And I'm like, what the heck? Like, I'm in Hanoi. Is the Communist Party now publishing the writings of traitors? I start reading it, and it turns out that, you know, what do they say about Pham Quyn? They say he basically saved Vietnamese culture and he promoted the Vietnamese language. He promoted Vietnamese culture at a time when the French were trying to erase Vietnamese identity. So who is Pham Quyn? Pham Quyn is probably the most important intellectual in the 1920s, hands down, easy, for the reason that his journal called Nam Phong was the most widely read intellectual journal. It was written in Vietnamese, Quốc ngữ, in Chinese, and in French. It had like all these languages. And what did he do in this journal? He basically said, here are ideas from the West that we Vietnamese should be interested in. And he tells the Vietnamese readers about Western thinkers. And why did he create this journal? The French hired him to be the editor of this journal so that the French can create an indigenous class of loyal Vietnamese to help the French rule Vietnam. And so Pham Quyn was always saying very nice things about the French. Like, we love France. France is so civilized. It's so amazing. It's so great. But you know what's interesting? When you look deeper into his writings, he's actually being quite subversive here because he's saying, hey, France, you're better than the Germans, you're better than the Italians, you're smarter than the Americans, you're more cultured than the Germans, you know, you're all these things. Why are you being so, you know, mean and bad in Vietnam, basically? Like, you're capable of so much better. Why do you need to dehumanize the Vietnamese, you know? So he's like criticizing the French in while flattering them and wheedling. But what he's doing is something very important, which is that he's really promoting Vietnamese culture. So The Tale of Gu by Nguyen Du, he's really promoting, he's saying like, people don't think that the Vietnamese have anything great. They're wrong. Look at The Tale of Gu. It's beautiful. It's perfect, you know? And the Vietnamese language is beautiful. It's perfect. And he's really just promoting Vietnamese culture so much. And he creates the language, like he has a vocabulary building project in Nam Phong, where he's like, our language doesn't have enough words to express everything, so I'm going to create it. And then he's like, here's a word from French, like democracy, you know, and so on. So he's creating a vocabulary.
You know, this whole thing that you bring up about France, you know, I deal with this stuff, the indignity of having French culture in my family. You know, it's such a weird, strange fascination. It's not even a love-hate. It's just a pure love. And I think when I'm surrounded by Vietnamese people, I don't see Vietnamese people ever hating on the French, just regular mm-hmm. Vietnamese people. They all seem to love the music. They love the aesthetics of French culture. They like the luxury goods that come out of France. They have this deep connection with the people of France and the history that is intertwined with the Vietnamese and the French. And then to hear, you know, academics and intellectuals talk about like the indignity of what was suffered by the Vietnamese through the hands of the French is a big thing, because I mean, how do you control millions of people if you don't have guns and killing, you know, and threats, right? And jailing people. But there's a fascination for me that to this day, Vietnamese culture, for the most part, love the French. And I'm wondering, here's my question to you. Were the French actually better at governing, at being more compassionate to their subjects, to their colonies?
So this is a good question. One name that's important here is Albert Sarraut. Albert Sarraut was one of the French governor generals in around like 1920s. And what's interesting is that he was a progressive. He was a socialist. And he promised to give the Vietnamese more representation in politics, basically. And in fact, many Vietnamese were optimistic. The Vietnamese who would end up being communists and anti-colonialists, they actually supported him. They were looking forward to his promises. But his promises never went through, partly because the French settlers who were in Vietnam opposed him, because they didn't want to get kicked out legally, right? So why was Albert Sarraut sent to this more, I guess, humane. By the way, he was super racist still, though, of course. Like, if you read his writings, he's like super problematic and racist. But you know, he was like, we will be more humane. We will not treat the Vietnamese like dogs. But he still, of course, thought they were inferior and so on. But why did the French send him? Because the Vietnamese had been trying to poison and assassin other French officials. So the French government was like, okay, we need to be nicer a little bit here, you know? But it's funny that you say, you know, today there's this love with France. I'm just thinking to Fanboy Joe, he has these writings where he's like, these men with yellow beards, they aren't our brothers or our fathers. They're, excuse my language, they're shitting on our heads.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. And you know, the pain that I suffer sometimes from my aunts is I have, my mom has five younger sisters, and many of them are, you know, they're taller women, they're beautiful. They were at once very beautiful in their towns and in their, wherever they lived. And they were many times told that they look like French women, right? And for some, you know, I get it that, you know, it's something that when you're poor and you come from these neighborhoods, that's a badge of honor for these women, right? And they never left this idea that, you know, their father was like 6'2", their grandfather was like very tall, and I'm a tall person. And this comes back in our family quite often. And they're like, oh, we have French blood. Look at these pictures of our ancestors, you know, Kim Wikao, you know, you have tall nose, light fair skin, and they're just taller people. They must be French, right?
Yeah.
So my brother and I took the 23andMe test a few years ago. We're like, all right, there's zero European ancestry, right?
Yeah.
We took it to another step. We took it another step. We said, okay, Tom and I, my brother and I, don't have any European ancestry. We'll let my mother take the test so she can go back and let the village know that we're, you know, we're not, there's no French blood here. So my mother takes the test, zero European ancestry. She presents this data back to her sisters. All of them deny it. They're like, nah, that's not real science. And at this point, I'm like, I'm livid. And for a long time, I was really upset that that they would be in love with their colonizers for so long. That how could you not just see the reality that this is like a real warped reality that you guys are living? And I'm still dealing with that, but now I find it comical.
I mean, one thing about colonialism, and you know, a lot of scholars have studied this with experiments, even in surveys and so on. Beauty standards, you know, a lot has been done on this, and there is a kind of internalized, you know, colonized peoples often internalize what the dominant, powerful people say is beautiful, right? I mean, look at the tradition of like blackened teeth, you know, the betel nut. Like these notions of beauty are of course constructed and used, especially during the colonial period, to maintain this domination, right? Europeans around the 1800s were competing with each other. They were competing with each other and they were fighting with each other, but they all kind of agreed that they were white and that the rest of the world was not white. And so the French, why did they choose Indochina? Well, they didn't want to rely on the British in Hong Kong to feel, you know, have a port to fuel their ships as they trade. You know, they need new markets. So one explanation of colonialism that I had mentioned earlier, this like, oh, they did it because they're just stronger. This changes when Marxism-Leninism becomes a popular thing. And that explanation is that the Europeans are colonizing because this is the logical outgrowth of capitalist logic. You know, when European capitalists exploit their workers in Europe, their workers are going to get upset and they're going to take to the streets. Well, make the workers happy and pay them more. But then we need cheap labor somewhere else. Let's go to countries where there are black and brown and yellow people, right? So we can exploit them. So that is the Leninist explanation for colonialism. I think the story, and I hope it's okay to go here, because I think, you know, the story of how communism comes to Vietnam is a very interesting one, and I like telling this story.
Why would it not be okay?
Right, I don't know. I think it's going to be okay.
This is the land of tangents. This is
yeah. So, I mean, this is a very well-known story, and you see it in documentaries and so on, but I think it's worth saying again that the story of Ho Chi Minh, where he's a young man, and then he gets on a boat in 1911 to go explore the world, and he just gets a job as a mess boy on a ship, on a French liner. He's just doing the dishes, cleaning the boat, you know. And then he ends up traveling the world for 30 years and doesn't come back until 1941.
Wow.
But one interesting thing is that when he's abroad, he's writing letters to Phan Chu Trinh. Keep in mind that Phan Chu Trinh was born in, all right, I'm going to remember the dates, in 1872, Phan Chu Trinh. You know what year Ho Chi Minh was born? 1890. Phan Chu Trinh is old enough to be Ho Chi Minh's father, but they're writing letters back and forth to each other. And Ho Chi Minh really, of course, he wasn't called Ho Chi Minh back then. He went by many other names. But Ho Chi Minh would see Fan Tu Chin as a mentor, you know? And I open my book with this scene where they get into a fight. And they get into a fight in Paris in 1919. So what happened? Ho Chi Minh is in Paris with Fan Tu Chin, and they're with other Vietnamese in Paris at the time in the 13th arrondissement and near Les Gobelins, where I actually lived there, near where they were. And so what happens in 1919? The European powers gather at the Paris Peace Conference to figure out what they're going to do after World War I. The world has, you know, things have been destroyed. How do they create the new world order after World War I? And so Woodrow Wilson is talking about self-determination for colonized peoples. And at this time, colonized peoples all throughout the French Empire are in Paris, and they're excited. They're like, oh my gosh, maybe we're going to get self-determination. Ho Chi Minh and Fan Tu Chin and Phan Van Trung, who's someone I don't write about a lot in my book, but the three of them, they write this list of demands. And what are the demands? Basic liberal rights, like we want freedom of speech, we want freedom of association, we want freedom of movement in Vietnam. They do not ask for independence. They just want these basic rights within French colonialism. And so Ho Chi Minh allegedly takes this list to the Versailles Conference, and he tries to give it to the delegates. And he feels like he's been ignored. And then he basically goes to Fan Tu Chin, and then he's like, I told you so. Fan Tu Chin, you keep saying that we need to wait, we need to ask the French for reforms, but they aren't doing anything. Nothing's going to happen if we don't take direct action. And then Fan Tu Chin says, look, we don't have any weapons. It's a suicide mission if we use any violence. And Ho Chi Minh yells back. And so how do we know that this argument happened? Well, the French hired a Vietnamese agent to scope out the place and record these sorts of dialogues. And so that's where I start my book, with this scene of them fighting. And then eventually, Ho Chi Minh is like, all right, I'm breaking with my mentor. I think he's old. I think he's wrong. And Ho Chi Minh takes this list. He walks around Paris, and he's trying to see if anybody is going to get on his side. You know who listens to him? The French socialists. At the time, the French socialists are very curious about what's happening in Russia. In 1917, the Russians are, for the first time in history, they're taking communism as an idea, and they're trying to make it real in the Russian Revolution, right? So Lenin is leading this revolution, and the French socialists are debating, should we join the Russians? Should we do what they're doing? What should we do? And so there's a leader among the French socialists named Jean Longuet, and he was Karl Marx's grandson. And he welcomes Ho Chi Minh into the meetings with the French socialists. And Ho Chi Minh is a young man. His French is not so good, but he can understand French. He's getting better at his French. And Ho Chi Minh's at these meetings, and they keep talking about how the workers are oppressed. And Ho Chi Minh says, why aren't you talking about the colonized peoples? You know, nobody's talking about us. You know, it's just a bunch of white people talking about white people. And then somebody at one of these meetings, they give him one of Lenin's essays called The Theses on the National and Colonial Questions. Ho Chi Minh takes this pamphlet home, and he reads it, and he starts crying. And he's just so moved. He's like, this is it. This is the path to our liberation. And from then on, he has total faith in Lenin. And what Lenin basically said was, he gave an explanation for colonialism, that it's an outgrowth of capitalism, and the solution is to have communist revolution. And so Ho Chi Minh starts writing about why the Vietnamese need communism, and then he starts sending these letters to Vietnam, smuggling them in there, and then through shoeboxes and stuff. And then people in Vietnam, they have like secret reading groups, basically. That's how communism comes to Vietnam. And so,
okay, I want to stop you real quick and then remember where we left off here. As you're telling me this stuff, I'm going, I can imagine your father, my father, you know, pre-75, if they heard, if they knew their sons were going to be talking about this one day on air like this, they'd probably not have us as, they'd probably kill us as babies, right? You know, I'm going a little too far with that example, but I think it's, it doesn't make our previous generation happy for us to be talking so openly about this. But we, you know, we're living in a new day and age. I could care less in terms of like where we stand. But I think we as children of these prior, you know, the people, previous generation, we have to be sensitive to their pain and their loss. All of that I understand, right? But here's what I want to ask you. When we think about these aspirations of these early thinkers like the Ho Chi Minh, and you know, he's going all around, you know, France and being in New York at one point, and he's begging for his people's liberation, and the goodness that we perceive as second generation, you know, Vietnamese American diaspora people, the goodness that we can perceive of just relinquishing or getting out of underneath the colonizers, that's a good thing. Okay, but where did it go wrong? From that point to our parents and the 1975, like, how did this go wrong in a civil war? I mean, take me to why there is so much anger and fighting and infighting between these subgroups that become, that tears the world apart now, you know? Because you can imagine, like, whatever you just said doesn't sound wrong to me. It sounds great. You know, are we communist sympathizers? I mean, no, it just sounds like what you're telling me makes a lot of sense. So where did it go wrong from that point to where we are today?
I just want to say that this podcast is going very smoothly because this perfectly takes me to the final thinker, Nguyen Minh Doug.
maybe we planned this before we talked.
We actually did not, listeners. But so, okay, so where did it go wrong? This is such an important question. And let me be clear, I have a lot of sympathy for those who suffered under communist rule, you know, those who were in re-education camps. I mean, both of my grandfather on my dad's side was in a re-education camp. My mom's father died in a re-education camp.
My father's father was killed by the Viet Minh in 1944, six months after my father was born. So I bleed the three red stripes. I get it. I'm part of that lineage. We are part of the, you know, third, fourth generation of these people. But we need to analyze the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me answer your question here. How did we, you know, get here? So what happened was communism becomes popular in North Vietnam around the 1930s. By the end of the 1930s, it just becomes the predominant ideology here. At the same time, during this time, you are beginning to see anti-communism as well. So everybody is anti-colonialist, but they have different ideas, different visions. Right. Different visions. The subtitle of my book is Vietnamese Visions of Decolonization. They have different visions of how to decolonize. And so, of course, some have the communist vision. But also within communism, you have differences. You have the Stalinists versus the Trotskyists, and they hate each other. And you also have anti-communists. Anyway, these tensions begin to brew. And by the 1950s, it brews into a violent conflict, basically, between communists and anti-communists. Now, the turning point, I would say, where things begin to look quite ugly is, the Viet Minh defeat the French at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, in May, okay? At the same time, in the North, the communists are creating what we would call a land reform campaign. Basically, they're taking land from who they perceive as wealthy landlords and giving it, redistributing it to the poorer peasants. Now, in this process, and this is very controversial. In the process, the leaders of the land reform admitted that they made mistakes, you know, that innocent people were persecuted, and quite a lot of people were executed, and the numbers are going to range wildly depending on who you ask. So I don't even want to get into the numbers of how many were executed or killed. But basically what happened was there was a lot of fallout from this. And Vaughn wins up. He gave a speech basically saying, all right, we made mistakes and so on and so on.
And this is one of Vietnam's biggest generals, the biggest general.
Yeah.
The Vietnam War. Yep.
And so he gives a speech saying, okay, we made mistakes. And at this point, the Communist Party is going to say, okay, we're going to, they don't quite directly say, okay, intellectuals in the party may now criticize us, but they sort of open this. And at the same time, a little bit later, we have a more famous in China, the 100 Flowers Movement. Maybe listeners are familiar with that, where the communists in China are saying, you know, Mao is going to say, okay, we're going to allow intellectuals to criticize the party, but friendly criticism. So they only allow communists to criticize communists. Mao Zedong is going to say that the most important tool for a communist revolutionary is criticism and self-criticism, which basically is a kind of purification. You know, you basically say, oh, I screwed up this way. I made these mistakes. I was a bad communist. And Ho Chi Minh is basically going to say, yes, Mao is right. And so we need to do criticism and self-criticism. That's how we improve. We're not perfect people. You know, we make mistakes. And so what happens now? Well, there's an intellectual named Nguyen Minh Tu. Very well-respected intellectual, partly because he was the first Vietnamese to get two PhDs from France, one in law, one in literature. Nguyen Minh Tu is a brilliant man. He teaches at universities in Hanoi. What does he do? He gives a speech basically saying that the Communist Party needs democracy and they need free speech. And he gives a speech, and then he gets a knock on his door one morning. One of his friends from the party is going to say, hey, you're in trouble. And so why is he in trouble? The party claims that they had no problem with his speech. They just say that his speech got leaked to the enemy, to the capitalist world, where the capitalists can use it against them. So the communists are going to be like, yes, criticize, but keep it in the family. You know, like, don't let your criticisms get to the enemies where they can exploit it. So Nguyen Minh Tu basically gets excommunicated from society. He never joined the party. He was never a communist. But he very clearly says he's not against communism, but he is against the communists. So he's going to say that the communists have become dogmatic. They've become rigid. They've become like dictators. They're not flexible. They're not open-minded. In fact, that goes against what Marx really thinks, you know. So he's gonna criticize him, but he's gonna praise socialism. Actually, he's gonna say, look, if we really want to create a good socialist society, you need to have free speech, you need to have democracy, you need to listen to the people. You can't be jailing people. People are just fake robots now. They're hiding in their homes and they're laughing with each other. But the moment they step outside, they need to like smile and nod to these masters of the Communist Party. Like, you know, that's wrong. So to answer your question, that's the land reform was a big one.
Really? Yeah, that really was the thing. It seems like modern day communists, I think there's two major things that I keep hearing thematically come up again. It's that land reform that really, they crossed the line. They really took care of they took out a lot of people. And then the other thing was the concentration camp, the re-education camps of after 1975. I think those two things really set off this really anger all over the world within French communist Vietnamese of the 50s, 60s, 70s. These people were like, they Zhu Hao, they were international students from Vietnam, landed in France, supported communist agendas, and they were communists themselves in France, being of Vietnamese descent. But once they started to have to deal with this re-education business, they were like, we're done. You guys are crossing the line. We understand that you had to do certain things in war, and to win the war, you had to do certain things. But now that you guys have already won, this whole re-education business is not the business. It should not be going on. And I think those two things have really made the international community upset.
Yeah. You know, my new interests now are these so-called re-education camps. When I talk to my dad about this, he says, don't call it a re-education camp, call it a forced labor camp. And so what's interesting is, so I started reading about the scholarship on so-called re-education camps. And if you look at the Vietnamese Communist Party's justification for them, they see it as a form of clemency, a form of mercy, a kind of opportunity for bad Vietnamese to come back to the nation, you know? And of course, I mean, it is an interesting question from a political theory perspective. Like someone who studies revolution, for example, if you're trying to create a new society,
you kill them all, right?
So that's the question is, like, do you really want to kill them all? How would that make you look to the international community? Like, no, you can't kill them all, actually. But what do you do with them? You know, so it becomes a very interesting question.
You re-educate them?
Yeah, but so Ian actually is doing a lot of interesting work here. And so she has a new project about this. I mean, her father was in a re-education camp. And as she was telling me, like, her dad would tell her that there would be discussion. Like, so there would be labor, but then there would also be like ideological discussion, you know? Anyway, my book focuses on the first half of the 20th century, but that's one thing that I wanted to bring up is to Nguyen Minh Tung. So I pair him with Ho Chi Minh because I think it's a nice pairing, because you have the Ho Chi Minh, you have this optimism, this vision, but then it goes quite, you know, bad, because humans are flawed creatures. And the moment they get some power, they're going to use it to abuse people that they don't like, you know? And so Nguyen Minh Tung kind of finishes this story by saying, you know, here's how it could go wrong. And Nguyen Minh Tung's solution are the ideas of Montaigne, which is basically to be a skeptic, to assume that you don't know everything, to assume that you have a lot more to learn from the diversity of people. You should not stifle free speech. You should learn from people and be curious.
I love the title of your book, The Architects of Dignity, because of the things that we just talked about, my childhood. When I heard the title, I was like, oh my God, I completely understand it. I understand why you came up with that title, but can you tell me about the journey of creating the actual, like, I mean, you could go so many different ways with the title of a book. And I know authors, you know, think about these things for years before they, you know, say, okay, we're going to the publishers with this title. How did this come about?
It's so funny. I actually have the Facebook conversation with my friend when I came up with the title, because first off, the title of the book, The Architects of Dignity, it actually has the argument of my book in there. Now, in the West, when political theorists talk about this word dignity, they think of dignity as something that's inherent in individuals. It's a very Christian idea that you're born as a human being with innate dignity. It's almost like natural to you. And so that's one assumption in the West, that it's innate in individuals. Another assumption is that it justifies human rights. Like, the reason why we have rights is because we have dignity. Yeah. The reason why we have the right to free speech, the right to vote, whatever, is because we have dignity. You know, animals don't have that because they don't have human dignity. Humans have something special. It's dignity. So that's another assumption. A third assumption is that dignity requires social recognition, that, you know, I need to recognize your dignity for you to have, for that dignity to mean something, really. Now, my book, it kind of challenges all of those assumptions, because these six thinkers that I write about, for them, dignity was first something for the nation. It was for the nation. It wasn't for individuals. It was like something that the nation had to create. So you have to construct dignity. Like, yeah, you can say dignity is natural, innate, but the French are gonna still abuse you. So like, what then, you know? And they actually think that you can take dignity away from yourself. Actually, it's possible. So it's not something that's always with you. You can take it away from yourself if you do nothing and you're being oppressed and you just take it. That's undignifying, you know? If you do drugs and mess up your body and mind, you're taking away your own dignity. So there is a way to construct your dignity, which is to assert yourself. And this requires a duty. Duty, and so that's the emphasis. It's not about rights, it's about responsibility and duty to create. And lastly, for them, they don't need to depend on French recognition of dignity. They can be like, screw you, we're going to create our own dignity. So the architects of dignity, I mean, I experimented with like creating dignity or making dignity or, you know, but they are architects because they are drawing up blueprints, you know, their own visions for how the Vietnamese can create dignity. And they're quite diverse. They have really different visions.
Now, where are we, you and I, second generation Vietnamese American diaspora, in the cycle of dignity for Vietnam? Where do we stand? Who are we? Are we able to contribute in a way that's meaningful? Or are we outsiders with dignity on the outside because we can say and think however we want? You know, where does this, I often think about, where am I in the building blocks of the history of Vietnam?
Yeah. You know, when I was in college and I loved political philosophy, my bookshelves were lined with Plato, Aristotle, Hobbes, you know, the thinkers that I mentioned earlier, Rawls, white men, basically. So I think I subconsciously assumed that Vietnamese people didn't do political theory. And so when I became a PhD student and I was trying to find a topic, I actually did not choose Vietnamese political thought at first. At first, I chose Michel de Montaigne, the French philosopher. But then I thought to myself, why, right? Why? And I realized that I think I had been brainwashed by the West to think that Vietnamese people didn't do political thinking. And so I see my book as my role in bringing dignity to Vietnamese political thought.
Nice.
And I genuinely think that these are creative moves, because what they're doing is they're doing what we would call engaged comparative political theory, where they're comparing between different philosophical traditions from different cultures to find the right ideas for them, right? So for their moment, what problems are they encountering right now? And what ideas? And I think we Americans can learn from that. It's like, what are the problems facing us right now? Political polarization, I don't know, climate change, whatever problem you have, maybe you should start looking to different cultures and finding the right ideas for you.
You know, I want to tell you that I constantly tell people and guests, you know, that I can't wait to have them back on the show, you know, and you're definitely, you know, I'm definitely going to make sure that message, you understand it and you grasp how much I enjoyed the session, you know, the conversation today. I truly would love to have you back on the show once a week. You know, there's so much more to talk about with the development. I'm sure we can get into the musical, the traffic in Vietnam and the architecture, the food. You and I could probably talk for months on end about the development of Vietnam and the philosophical sort of angles of the development of the Vietnamese American diaspora. So thank you so much for coming on, and I really enjoyed our conversation today.
You know, I have to say thank you so much. You're actually the first, this is the first time I'm doing a book talk of sorts after my book came out. My book came out 3 weeks ago, and I haven't had a chance to talk about it with someone. And so thank you for giving me the opportunity, because it helps me think and clarify, you know, why what this book means and why I think it matters. But it's been a real pleasure, and Thanks again.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.